Victor, are you thoroughly impressed with the headquarters here at Chicago Jazz Publishing and Entertainment?
It's the most beautiful dungeon I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Victor. Everybody, it's Mike Jeffers, ChicagoJazz.com, Chicago Jazz Magazine. Welcome to Talkin' Jazz. We are here at the Chicago Jazz offices shooting episode 126. I am here joined by the extraordinary trumpet player, Victor Garcia. He has a show coming up February 19th at City Winery. He has a brand new recording out entitled The Grind, The Groove. We're going to talk about all of that. But before we get into that, Victor, are you thoroughly impressed with the headquarters here at Chicago Jazz Publishing and Entertainment?
It's the most beautiful dungeon I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Victor. Dungeon. Yes, that's what a lot of people call that. But we're on the third floor, but it's a nice third floor dungeon.
I think it's wonderful.
Absolutely. Well, so we're in an old Spiegel warehouse, so there's echoing a little bit. So I don't know how this is going to sound on the podcast. Obviously, those of you watching the video can see that the office is not a dungeon.
No, and I'm just getting over a little cold, so this is my sexy voice too.
Perfect. I'm glad you explained that to everyone. But all right, so let's talk a little bit before we get into your background and how you got into trumpet and everything. You've got a show coming up February 19th at City Winery.
Tuesday.
It's a Tuesday. Well, that's not bad, mm-hmm. Right? A Tuesday at City Winery. That's awesome. And it's with your septet.
Yep.
And your organ septet, right? Is that what you would call it, an organ septet? And is it the same group that's on the recording?
Pretty much. We might have a different guitar player, but waiting to hear on Scott Hesse, super busy cat and amazing player. So if not, Mike Alamano will be there, but yeah.
Yeah, and you're going to be playing tunes from the new release, obviously, I would imagine.
We did a CD release already at Space back in November, so this show, I'll definitely do a lot of my originals, but I also have some other arrangements that I've done in the past few years, and I want to take them out for a spin, so hopefully you can come out and enjoy those.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit, but of course you can get more information at citywinery.com, and then also victorgarciamusic.com. You have all the information up there, and you can also pick up the brand new release. But why don't we talk a little bit about this release first? I mean, you know, going through it and listening to it, I took a brief listen through it, and it sounds just like you. It's amazing.
Yeah. My stand-in did a great job.
But it's interesting to me because, you know, with a trumpet player, usually they don't go with an organ concept, right? I mean, a lot of times there's you know, saxophone with an organ-based trio or something behind it. But sure. I haven't heard a lot. Of course, you're a trumpet player, so you probably have heard more.
Maybe.
But I haven't heard a lot with an organ-based rhythm section behind a trumpet player. And then, of course, on this recording, you also have trombone, tenor sax, alto sax. So, I mean, you have it's almost like a little big band.
Exactly. The concept was a mini big band meets an organ trio. I've always loved the organ sound. I think it's very churchy, it's very soulful, very bluesy, but it's also very diverse. You can play a lot of different things, and it evokes so many emotions, and that's why I decided to put a little mini big band on top of that.
Did you, how many originals are on her? Are they all originals?
They are.
They're all originals. So these are all your originals. How long did it take you to write?
Myself.
How long did it take you to put something like this together? I mean, is this kind of like you've been working on these tunes over a longer period of time and you finally just got them all together and said, let's do this?
Yeah. Some of these tunes I've written many, many years ago. But, you know, I finally brought it all together a couple years back and decided to put it all in the studio. And I'm glad I pulled the trigger because I have no money now. And no, I'm really excited about this. And this is a long time coming. I've been on a bunch of other people's CDs and really happy about that. Learned a lot. But I think it was time for me to put something out on my own. And I'm glad I did.
Yeah,
thank you for having me here.
Well, no, I'm glad you're here. And why don't we talk a little bit about, you know, how did you got started on trumpet at an early age? Is that what I'm assuming? I mean,
early enough. I started in high school.
Okay.
And story is a little funny. I'll cut it down. But I had already been playing piano and guitar, singing with my dad and brother in a trio setting, which is like a romantic music from Mexico and Latin America, really.
What did they play? What did your brother?
Oh, my bro plays requinto, which is a small melodic guitar. And then my dad played requinto or guitar. And my job was to find the chord. So I just played regular guitar and sing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Stuff. Oh. It was actually the best school for me to learn harmony.
You guys were doing three-part harmony.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But it was my job to find the chords many times. And
oh, okay.
We didn't have GPS back then, so it was the best I could.
Well, and you're not playing trumpet, so you're playing guitar, you're playing something else. Is that...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was back in the day. But then when I joined... Sorry.
No. Hey, charge.
My dad brought some instruments from a flea market one day, and he said, "You guys take your pick." And earlier that day, I had gotten into an argument with him, so I got last pick, of course. So my little brother picked the drums, which is what I wanted to play. And my sister picked the clarinet because there was a boy she liked that played clarinet. She wanted to sit next to him. And my other brother didn't want to play anything, so he picked the flute because he found out that you could fit it in your book bag really easily.
A smart guy.
And I got stuck with the trumpet.
You got stuck with the... You know how many different musicians I talk to, though? It's funny because they want to play the drums, or they want to play this, or they want to play that, and then they end up by, like, the last common denominator now. Well, all right, I guess I'll play that. And now they've played that for 30 years,
yeah,
and they love it.
It happens a lot.
And they love it. So you picked up the trumpet then. Did all of the chords and stuff, I mean, did any of that help you when you first started playing trumpet, or did it?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I learned that the best teacher that you can have is yourself. So I tried so many different ways to try to create a sound out of it. It didn't work at first. It was just a complete...
Yeah.
I didn't really understand the concept of buzzing, but, by just will...
Mm-hmm.
Sure will. I made it happen, and I even learned wrong. I had like all these bad habits playing notes with alternate fingerings. I had no idea.
Oh, really?
Well, great.
So you're just learning on your own. You're learning by ear.
I did until my senior year when I finally got a teacher, the late great Michael McLaughlin. Actually, a tune is dedicated to him, "The Trail Home."
Hmm. Okay.
But he basically whipped me into shape. We would sit in lessons, and he'd listen to me play an etude. And I knew he didn't do a great job, so I'd kind of put my head down. And he would say really sarcastically, "Oh, that would have been great if you didn't press the suck button." Or, "On a scale from one to suck, how do you think that went?" So it was by tough love that I was able to break all those habits.
But a lot of times that's the best way to do it, because it probably connected with you better than him just like screaming at you or something. And
well,
maybe he did scream at you.
It got me to do it.
Yeah.
It got me to practice for sure, because I would fear those moments.
And did you, so as you're learning it that way and you're getting better and better and better, are you enjoying it more and more and more? So you're practicing more and more and more?
Oh, big time, big time. The better you get, the more the enjoyment factor goes up for sure. So
were you getting into jazz at that point, or was that classical, mm-hmm. or what was it?
Yeah, I mean, classical was never really, that's what he tried to get me on, get my Arbenz, Clark studies and stuff together.
Yeah.
And I was just always the worst trumpet player in the room. But I had an ear, because I had an experience playing harmony and singing harmony and finding the right notes. And
mm-hmm.
So I knew the basic rule. Nobody taught me, but I knew the rule about like a good harmony note being a third or a sixth away.
Yeah.
And that really helped me get through a lot of that. I was transcribing before.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, but I didn't even, all my stems and flags were backwards in my notation, and I was just doing it just because I really loved it, wanted to sound like Clifford Brown and Charlie Parker.
Is that somebody that you listened to, like, first off, you heard Clifford Brown or Lee Morgan or somebody like that, like, at an earlier age, like during high school, and that kind of caught your ear?
The first guy that I heard was actually Dizzy Gillespie. This is a funny story. Me and my bro were making prank calls. And
just random prank calls just went. Yeah.
It was fun. Me and my bro were making some prank calls, and we were using this service called 1010321, which you could block your number.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
But we didn't know it was raking up my dad's phone bill. And so we got a sheet in the mail that said, "You get a free CD for using this service so many times." And my brother freaked out. He's like, "Here, you take it." And so I was like, "All right, well, if I'm going to go down, might as well get something to show for it. And I had no idea who any of the artists were, because my dad only really listened to really old music at home. So, you know, I knew the Beatles lyrics by heart.
Yeah.
You know, he loved Dave Brubeck.
So that's really old music, is the Beatles and...
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, it was definitely not playing on the radio.
Right, okay.
At that time. Yeah. So I saw a picture of, a white picture of Dizzy Gillespie and the cheeks popping out.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's interesting. And the trumpet looks weird. Let me try that one. And it was a RCA Victor, Dizzy Gillespie Greatest Hits. And it blew my mind. I wore it out transcribing a bunch of stuff on there because... was really inspiring, you know. I couldn't believe that the trumpet could be played like that.
Yeah, and you were transcribing it, and I want to ask you this because I find that the players that really love playing, they transcribe it just to transcribe it because they want to find out what the heck this person was playing, as opposed to like being forced to transcribe this whole thing by a teacher. You were transcribing it because you wanted to learn, like, what the heck is he doing, right?
Exactly. But essentially, it's... As a jazz musician, it's your way to learn how to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I was picking up all sorts of language from all my heroes at the time.
Yeah.
Even if I couldn't play it perfectly, because, I mean, Dizzy Gillespie was screaming high A flats and whatever.
Right, right.
I couldn't. At the time, I was getting headaches trying to play it, but, you know.
Did you think you had to start playing with your cheeks out because you saw him? Not that you do, but that's
what, you know. But it never felt comfortable for me, so I just did it, you know, my own way, which was... with a piece of gum right by my lower gum over here. It was really weird, and that's how I could play. And Mike McLaughlin corrected that.
Oh, I bet.
And he didn't even know. The first few lessons, I would show up, you know, and the gum was already in place, and I would play.
Yeah.
But one time I was late to the lesson because I ran out of gum. So I had to stop by a J.J. Pepper's, pick up a pack. And he's like, where were you? I said, I had to pick up some gum. I'm like, what? What the F? I said, well, you know, I can't play without it. What the F? So he made me spit it out.
Double what the F, right? Yeah. Double. So did you go to college?
I did. I went to UIUC, so in Champaign.
Oh, okay.
For a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed it there, but it was really far. It was 2.5 hours one way. And at the time, I was already getting some calls to come back and do some gigs. And
who was teaching down there then?
At the time, it was, well, the late... Dr. Ewald, Mike Ewald, amazing classical trumpet player. And Ronald Rahm is still there of the Canadian Brass.
Oh, yeah.
So I got to study with both of them.
Oh, wow.
They really gave me a great foundation. Actually, the warm-up that I teach to this day came from Ronald Rahm.
Really?
Yeah, super incredible trumpet player, great teacher, very thoughtful about concepts and great ways of explaining them. So yeah, it was very instrumental. But at the time, there was no jazz trumpet teacher down there. There was a guy who was teaching, like, arranging, Thomas Wirtle, but everyone calls him Shab Dunur. That was his
Shab Dunur
mystical name.
Oh, okay.
Incredible writer, really funny guy. And
so you're down there, but you were really actually focused more on just like the basic classical, chop driven, you know, well, not chop driven, but building up your basics, right? I mean, because that's what classical teaching is, right?
Day, yeah. I noticed that being a jazz musician is like your chops are constantly trying to catch up to your ideas.
Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that a lot of people, especially the young musicians that watch the show and listen to this podcast, hear me talk about this a lot when I talk to different musicians. And it's always fascinating, no matter what level you're at or how long you've been in the business, the really good players, you being one of them, still have that focus on a warm-up, working on certain things, working on chops. You're just not sitting down and saying, okay, I'm just going to blow over all these changes today and my chops will be just fantastic and that'll be the end of it, right? I mean, you're constantly keeping that up. Otherwise, it slips a little, right, if you don't do that.
Man, trumpet is worse than a girlfriend. If you don't see your girl for a couple days, I could buy her some flowers, some chocolates, maybe write her a poem. Come on, baby, you know. She'll warm up to you. If you don't play the trumpet for a couple of days and you pick it up, you don't touch me for a couple of days, turn into like a Puerto Rican chick. No offense. I love Puerto Rican chicks.
No, but that's true, right? What about But what about when you're traveling and stuff and you can't do a proper warm-up? Is it just at least putting a mouthpiece in and doing warm-ups like that? That probably helps
a ton,
right? Yeah, you find
different ways. I have a silent brass, and when I'm traveling, I always practice at the airports. If I'm like in the driver's seat or in the back seat, I'm doing long tones and lip slurs, you know.
Yeah.
It's a lifelong commitment. It takes a lot, but I'm in too deep.
You're not getting out now. You're in.
Yeah.
So you came back to Chicago, and you started playing gigs and doing everything. What was one of the first like steady groups that you were in that you would say is like, okay, I'm going to be a professional musician. This is what I'm doing. You know, whether it's a steady group or maybe you're just playing enough gigs. Was there a gig or a group or something?
There is one that automatically comes to my mind was a band called Latin Inspiration. I used to call it Latin Perspiration because it was such a hard gig. It was great, but it required you to have lead chops and also to solo. It was a Latin jazz outfit, trumpet, tenor, trombone, and two or three piece percussion section and piano and bass. It was such a great experience. I learned a lot. And actually, there is a CD out there.
Whose band was that? Was that yours? Did you start that or?
Mm-mm. That was a John Rodriguez.
Oh, okay.
Trombone player.
Yeah, thing. Yeah.
Yeah, he was super driven to, you know, play this music. And he himself didn't write any of the music, but he had me and Pancho, the piano player, write some arrangements. And then he had me do some transcriptions. And another trumpet player, Kenny Anderson, did a bunch of transcriptions and play some covers. But it was great. We used to have like a steady gig at a place called Minx downtown.
Yeah.
For a while.
Yep.
We had a residency at the Winds Cafe.
I remember the Winds Cafe. That's,
I love that place. It was great.
Yeah. And, so you're doing that. Is that when you really started maybe venturing into writing some originals and things like that too? Were you writing at that point for that band or any other band?
I did write a little bit for that band. Every band that I've been involved with, I've had the opportunity to contribute some original, either original material or arrangements for a particular tune or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And all that has contributed to who I am today as a writer. Those influences.
But it sounds like you kind of taught yourself how to do that. Did you study that somewhere, or you just taught yourself how to do that?
Well, like, the same way that I learned how to play jazz, which was transcribing solos, I used to transcribe big band charts sometimes, like listen to some Thad Jones, Mel Lewis, and listen to like the way that the trombones lead and, you know, try to listen to the inner voices.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot. And then I would also like sometimes look at scores from the libraries, the schools that I went to, and like studied what they would do, the problem they would have, like having so many horns and only so many chord tones available, the things you could do, what to double, you know, stuff like that. I mean, it's a lot to learn, so I can't even go into it.
Well, it's also a lot of stuff that I think that some people need the structure of college, the structure of something to say, this is what you're doing, this is why you're doing it, blah, 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 blah. And then others, I think of myself as that side, where it's like, you know what, I just want to get this done. I don't care if it's going to take me 100 hours of me figuring this out on my own. I'm just going to nail this, get done with it, and be done. And you sound like you're the second, like me, where you're like, I'm really interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to just sit down and spend all my time doing this because I want to figure this out. Is that kind of the way you're thinking about stuff?
Pretty much. Yeah. Pretty much. And you know, not to say that I didn't learn a lot from my professors. But,
right.
But yeah, I think that the best teacher will ultimately be you. You know? I mean, obviously you don't know the information, but if you have a mind to learning something and dissecting it and figuring it out, then you can really brainstorm and try to pick it apart and say, okay, where can I go to attain some of this information? Or, you know, what have I heard? Mostly, what have I heard to inspire this thought in the first place?
Right.
Know? Like, maybe there was a chart that really blew my mind. Or, you know, listening to music growing up, and I would always notice which tunes would give me goosebumps because the harmony was, you know, like, for example, that string interlude in the middle of Nat King Cole's Mona Lisa. When it does that descending thing, it just, every single time it gets me, I get goosebumps. So, you know, I transcribe that because I want to know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Put my finger on it.
Yeah.
And figure out what the magic was all about, you know, so that I could include that in some of my compositions later, or the concepts of it.
Well, and you're naturally curious about that. That's mm-hmm. that's even if you were in college, you'd probably be killing it because you would just be naturally curious, and you'd probably be the person that they'd say, "Hey, why don't you transcribe this Thad Jones, Mel Lewis tune?" Mm-hmm. And then you would transcribe the entire album,
right.
And they'd be like, "Okay." But I think you go down the wormhole, right? And you start getting interested, and that's how you start to find out a lot about a lot of stuff.
Well, the practice room is like a time vortex. You know,
it is.
A couple times, I remember one time I would do this often. I would wake up before high school and start practicing, warming up or whatever. And one time I got so into it because I had figured something out the day before, and I looked at the clock and it was like 11:30 a.m. I said, "Whoops." And then
you missed high school.
My mom came home. She's like, "How was school?" I said, "Great." Back to it. You know. I mean, you shouldn't do that, kids.
Yeah, no, don't do that. But it goes to show you too. I mean, that's how, like, when I was learning drums, it's the same thing. I mean, I could practice for 15, 17 hours and not even mm-hmm. think about it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a drag. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It was just not a drag. And now, you know, then fast forward and you start working and you've got other obligations and everything else. Mm-hmm. It's nice to just go into the practice room and just like, wait a minute. I don't have to worry about anything here for like a half an hour, 40 minutes, whatever it is, right?
Time does become more precious as you grow up and responsibilities take over. But you still have the choice to prioritize whatever you need to. And even if I only have like 30 minutes,
mm-hmm.
I'll hit it hard. I'll put my phone in another room or something and
right.
really be focused. Even though then I probably will go more than half an hour if I don't have a timer or something. But yeah, more importantly than time is the quality of your practice.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, so after Latin Inspiration, what other groups? Was it the Chicago Afro-Latin Jazz Ensemble?
That came later even. I was playing... Excuse me.
I'm surprised I said that all in one phrase correctly, because I always mess it up somehow. Cal J is the how everybody always says it,
I'm proud of you, man. Yeah.
Thank you. You know, it's almost like I run a magazine. I've read that somewhere before.
So I started playing in the salsa scene pretty heavy. I had some friends that were involved, and I got a lot of experience. As a matter of fact, it got me a lot of chops too.
Oh, I bet.
Very demanding playing. You know, it has to be clean. It was great. I mean, it was a great compliment to all the jazz studies.
Well, and you tell me too, because I mean, if you're in the salsa scene, like if you were just in the jazz scene and you're playing jazz trumpet, you're probably playing, I don't know, maybe a couple nights a week if you're lucky mm-hmm. at that age and all that other stuff. I mean, it's not like, but the salsa scene, I mean, tell me, but I think that there's opportunities for you to play probably a lot more than just straight ahead jazz trumpet gigs, right? If you're on the salsa scene, I mean,
yes and no. It's
because I remember like 10 years ago, there was a lot of things happening on the salsa thing, right? I mean, there was a lot of stuff popping.
I think people still to this day, cats that I play with, will talk about the 90s.
Yeah.
When there were gigs every single night.
Yeah,
and sometimes multiple times a night where they'd play a gig and they'd run to another club. And I never knew that scene.
Right.
And I've experienced something like that, but it was not like salsa.
Mm.
Like I'll do a jazz gig and then go to a salsa gig or something. Or I'll do a jobbing gig, then I'll go to a merengue gig at 2 a.m.
Don't do that. But, I mean, you're right, though, because, I mean, the chops, and you're using your chops differently for salsa, differently for jazz, differently, mm-hmm. and they all start complementing each other, I would imagine. So then when you're playing a jazz gig, you probably have, like, really clean chops because you just played a salsa gig for 4 hours somewhere else the day before, and it all kind of builds up, right? I mean, it's different.
It depends, you know. You got to take care of your chops.
Yeah.
One of my teachers, who's very influential, and not only trumpet playing, but in life, is Art Davis. And he would say that practicing is like putting money in the bank. Playing gigs is taking money out of the bank.
Yeah.
And
well, that's interesting.
And it's exactly yeah. It feels like that, you know? If I play salsa gig, and then I go to a jazz gig, my chops are so raw from so much, you know, loud screaming
yeah.
that it's hard to get a nice, soft...
Yeah, a warm tone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've had to learn how to warm down, for example. If I'm like going to another gig, I'll do some mouthpiece buzzing to make sure that I could center in a good sound. I
mean, mm-hmm.
Nobody knows what we trumpet players have to go through.
Well, and also, I mean, every style is different. It's like if you're playing, just like if you're playing a guitar and you're playing like in a AC/DC cover band, and then you go to play a Wes Montgomery gig after that, I think you're changing some things around, right? Yeah, I mean, so it's the same thing with trumpet, mm-hmm. where you have to know the style. You have to understand what your tone is, probably, because mm-hmm. your tone has to change per whatever's happening, sure. too.
Play the music appropriately.
Yeah.
So whatever the gig is, you got to play the gig.
So how did the Cal J group get together? Because you're one of the founding members of that, right?
Yep. So I was at Northern. I had already switched over to Northern Illinois.
Okay, so you came back from U of I, and then you were here, and then you ended up going to Northern.
I actually transferred
just right to Northern. Okay.
Because it was a lot closer.
And that's where Art teaches, yeah. right? Art Davis. That's yeah, where, he's dynamite, yeah, man. I've known. He's been somebody that's helped me since the '90s mm-hmm. with my playing and stuff, and playing with a drummer that was like half good at that point mm-hmm. and didn't tell me how bad I was. You know, thanks, Art. But he's the best. But anyways, okay. So that's where you met him, and so you're up at NIU at that point, mm-hmm. and you're playing around the city and doing a lot of stuff, and then the Cal J thing kind of came out of that.
Well, it was a weird way that it happened. I made a friend in the salsa scene at the time. His name is Darwin Noguera, piano player,
mm-hmm.
and we met in this basement on Cicero in some rehearsal band. The band was called Orquesta Leal. It was a little salsa band. I think they're still around.
Yeah,
great dudes. But he asked me to transcribe a bunch of music for the band. So I did. I wrote a bunch of charts, some big band stuff. I brought in some smaller group stuff, and we went to Miami and did a concert together.
Really? Yeah, just like, boom, let's go. Here you go.
The first version of Cal J was actually, it wasn't even called Cal J. We just went to Miami and played like a Latin big band gig. And it was great. It was cool. Emilio Valdez was on it.
Mm-hmm.
Chucho Valdez's son, the drummer. And one of my best friends, Rocky Yera, was in it.
Mm-hmm.
Another 20-year-old like me.
He was going to school down there, right? Yep. At that point, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so that's where we met, the first time we met. And so I wrote all this music. We did this concert. It was in a church, which is interesting. And then I came back, and nothing happened until we got a call to play at the Hot House. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, yeah, sure, of course. Yeah.
It was to open up the Jazz Enclave Festival, which was cool. They used to bring different artists.
They used to bring international touring artists through there, right?
Yeah.
For specific to whatever genre of music they were focused on. So correct. At that point, it was salsa, Latin jazz,
Latin
whatever.
Jazz.
Yeah.
And they wanted to feature Chicago artists, so that's when we got the call.
And you guys weren't really playing as that group yet, right?
No, that was our first.
Yeah.
Gig. Yeah.
How did they find out about you guys? Just because you guys had been playing in so many different bands, somebody told them, "Hey, why don't you call Victor?"
I think because Darwin was working.
Okay.
There at the
oh he's working house. At the Hot House a lot.
I think he was like working with somebody there, and somehow they asked him to, and he called me. He's like, "Hey, you still got all those charts?" I was like, "Yeah, all right, let's do it."
it's like a typical, like, you know, all these people that are sitting in the crowd and audience, and they're like, "Oh my god, this is unbelievable." That's exactly how a lot of these gigs happen. Mm-hmm. Hey man, you still got all those charts that we used in Miami? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Let's call some people, man. I think we got a gig,
exactly.
Right? That was it.
And that was the first.
How'd you come up with the name?
Initially, it was like an attempt to kind of try to get some funding from Columbia, college.
Sure.
They had the Chicago Jazz Ensemble, which was, so we were trying to be like the Latin side, kind of like, the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra,
yeah.
The Afro-Latin.
I like that, the marketing aspect, man,
yeah.
Look at that.
It was, it didn't quite work out that way, but it was great. And actually, funny story, years later, when John Faddis took over the Chicago mm-hmm. Jazz Ensemble, and he found out that the Chicago Afro-Latin Jazz Ensemble was trying to like ride on the star, he gave me some crap about it.
Oh, did he?
He had a good laugh about it, but yeah. He knows why. But yeah, me and John are cool.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, I mean, you guys did that, and then I can remember all of a sudden you started playing here, there, right, as that group. And I know you recorded something for Chicago Sessions, but was that mm-hmm. before or after? I mean, you played the Chicago Jazz Fest, or you played jazz in Chicago or something like that. I mean, all of a sudden you started getting these bigger, higher profile mm-hmm. gigs with that band.
Yeah, I mean, I think taking the initiative to do stuff for yourself is ridiculously important, because people see that, and I mean, those are the people that are carrying the torches yep. today. You know, the people that have jumped to it, they don't wait for instructions. They, you know, they want to do something original, something different, something authentic,
mm-hmm.
true to oneself and their own personal growth. And I was lucky to be on board for that, because I was nowhere near ready to learn that lesson, honestly.
Right.
That's why this has taken me so long.
Yeah. Well,
but being around players that, you know, trusted me to co-lead in a situation, for example, you know, we divvied up the work so that I wasn't the one that had to be the business guy, for example.
Right, right. You were writing, you were arranging, yeah, and then somebody else was dealing with some of that other stuff, and somebody else would deal with logistics. And
I was part of a, you know, more or less well-oiled machine.
But jumping a little, check out this transition, mm-hmm. all the way up to this recording mm-hmm. and your gig February 19th at City Winery.
Yeah, exciting.
You probably learned a lot from working with that group and watching what was going on and then being mm-hmm. a part of that. And then all of these other groups. I mean, you play in the Chicago Jazz Orchestra, mm-hmm. and that's a well-oiled machine where there's a lot of logistical things going on and a lot of different things.
Every musical situation that I get myself into, I always learn something, either what I should do or what I shouldn't do.
Yeah. Well, that's the nature of the whole thing, you know. Then you try to cut down on the things you shouldn't do mm-hmm. and make the things you should do grow. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you one know. Of the things, for example, I never knew that it mattered so much to me, but I did this gig with Cano Estremera. It's a salsa singer.
Okay.
And his musical director is a brother of some guys in town, amazing percussionist named Godwin Vargas. And we were on stage, and he was about to count off the song, and he went, "Oh, I forgot something." He reaches in his coat, and he pulls out a bunch of envelopes, and he just starts handing out the money for the gig. Right before we play. Well, we played really happy that day, because we didn't have to wait until 4 a.m. for our money. We didn't have to call the band leader 2 weeks later, like, yeah. "Hey, man."
Yeah, you know? Right, right.
It was great. So I was like, I'm going to do that. So now I have a habit of paying musicians right before a gig or immediately after.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I notice it makes a difference, because people want to work with you if you're a professional businessman.
Right.
You don't want to cross friendship and business. It's one and the other, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's also like you know, you're running a business. I mean, you know, I talk about this on the show a lot too, mm-hmm. with different musicians, that, you know, when you get out of college, if you go to college for jazz, you get out of college, they don't tell you that suddenly now you're in business for yourself,
right?
But they didn't give you any business information. You can play Wayne Shorter tunes and everything mm-hmm. else, but you have no idea how to file 1099s.
Correct.
And which I have to do later today.
Ooh.
and and all of the other business stuff that you have to deal with. And it's just like, oh my God, man. And it's like trial and error. So it's good that you learn and you watch, because I think a lot of musicians too, they just like, okay, cool, I got paid, whatever, see you later. They're not, you're taking lessons from all these different mm-hmm. things. And that's something you're probably passing along to your students too, I would imagine.
Big time, because there's things that you learn at school and things that you have to learn on the gig. But I've noticed that you can save them a lot of pain if you were to just take the things that you've learned on the gig and be able to convey them to a student in the classroom too.
Mm-hmm.
It's very valuable.
Oh, yeah.
And they definitely appreciate it. Not everyone will have the head to hear it at that time in their career, but it's in there.
Mm-hmm.
And one day down the line, oh, yeah, Mr. Garcia said. Mm-hmm. Yes, he did.
That's it. Well, and you're right, because, I mean, you know, 15 years down the road, all of a sudden the kid will be sitting there going, wait a minute, Victor told me about this. That's okay, I know what to do,
right.
You know, and it's important. So jumping over to your new release, which is available at victorgarciamusic.com. I'm assuming it's on iTunes and everywhere else as well.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So you're going to be performing this February 19th, music mm-hmm. from this release. I love the name, too, The Grind, The Groove. Talk a little bit about, I read the inside, so I know what it means, but talk a little bit about what it means so that they understand the title, if they're not looking inside the CD and reading it.
Sure. well, you should. It kind of doesn't make sense otherwise, except if you're a musician, you know, or not just musician, but I think I learned it from jazz musicians that if you're in the grind, that means that you're working hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always associated grind with that. And then groove is it's the most important thing about the music. If it doesn't feel good, then what's the point?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the thing with this recording, and that's the thing you're going to hear on February 19th, is I love the grooving on this stuff. I mean, and not that I was expecting it wouldn't be, but mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's my biggest thing is that I think casual music fans, hardcore jazz fans, but casual music fans, they don't care a lot of times if it's jazz, Latin, pop, rock. If it feels good, they're happy. They're going to show up. It's going to be fun. Everybody's going to have a great time. And that's what I think this recording does.
Yeah, there's only two kinds of music, country and Western.
And this is neither. Well, so you can hear all of these tunes February 19th at City Winery. So it's citywinery.com/Chicago. But if you just go to City Winery, you just took the mic out. So citywinery.com, February 19th, citywinery.com/Chicago, and of course, victorgarciamusic.com. Man, I'm glad you made it down here.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm glad we made this thing happen. It's going to be the coldest day of the year tomorrow, so we made it happen the day before the coldest day of the year.
Probably a good idea.
Yeah, well, I agree. But as I always end this, Victor, of course, is playing all over town in different groups and different things. He's leading his one specific group February 19th. But check his website, victorgarciamusic.com, for all the different spots you might be able to hear him. Chicago Jazz Orchestra, Trumpet Summit. I think you do some things with them at Andy's, different things like that. But if you want to hear Victor's tunes, February 19th, City Winery. And as I always end the show, hopefully you will check out Victor on February 19th, City Winery. And hopefully I will see you somewhere here, there, or wherever. But if we don't, hopefully we will see you somewhere out on the scene.